pink world, so Risa had told her. It was the way she had earned a living in a world that didn't make it easy for women to work. Meggie would have liked to hear the story again now, even if it had a sad ending. For after that, Risa's years of unhappiness had begun. But wonderful things had happened during that time, too, like the great banquet at the Laughing Prince's castle to which Mortola had taken her maids, the banquet where Risa saw the Laughing Prince himself and the Black Prince and his bear, the tightrope walker called Cloud Dancer. But Risa hadn't come into her room to tell her all those stories again. She said nothing in reply. And when her fingers did begin to speak once more, they moved more slowly than usual. "Forget the ink world, Meggie," they said. "Let's both of us forget it, at least for a little while, for your father's sake, and for yours. Or one day, you may be blind to the beauty around you here." She looked out the window again at the gathering dusk. "I've told you all about it already," said her aunts. "Everything you wanted to know." So she had, and Meggie had asked her many questions, thousands and thousands of them. "Did you ever see one of the giants? What sort of clothes did you wear? What did the fortress look like in the forest where Mortola took you? And that prince you talk about, the Laughing Prince? Was his castle as huge and magnificent as the Castle of Night? Tell me about his son, Cosimo the Fair, and the Adderhead and his men-at-arms. Was everything in his castle really made of silver? How big is the bear that the Black Prince always keeps beside him? And what about the trees? Can they really talk? And that old woman, the one they call Nettle, is it true that she can fly?" Risa had answered all these questions as well as she could, but even 1,000 answers did not add up to a whole 10 years. And there were some questions that Meggie had never put to her. She'd never asked about Dustfinger, for instance. But Risa had talked about him all the same, telling her that everyone in the ink world knew his name, even many years after he had disappeared. Of course, he was known as the Fire Dancer, too, so Risa had recognized him at once when she met him for the first time in this world. There was another question that Meggie didn't ask, although it often came into her mind. For Risa couldn't have answered it. What about Fenolio, the writer of the book that had drawn first her mother and finally even its own author into its pages? How was Fenolio now? More than a year had passed since Meggie's voice had cast the spell of Fenolio's own words over him, and he had disappeared as if they had swallowed him up. Sometimes, Meggie saw his wrinkled face in her dreams, but she never knew if it looked sad or happy. Not that it had ever been easy to read the expression on Fenolio's tortoise-like face anyway. One night, when she woke suddenly from one of these dreams and couldn't get to sleep again, she had begun a story in which Fenolio was trying to write himself home again, back to his grandchildren and the village where Meggie had first met him. But, as with all the other stories she'd started to write, she never got past the first 3 sentences. Meggie leafed through the notebook that Mo had taken away from her and closed it again. Risa put a hand under her chin and looked into her face.
"Don't be cross with him."
"I never am. Well, not for long. He knows that."
"How much longer will he be away?"
10 days, maybe more."
"Ugh, 10 days?"
Meggie looked at the shelf beside her bed. There they were, neatly arranged side by side. The bad books, as she secretly called them. Full of Risa's stories, tales of glass men and water nymphs, fire elves, nightmares, white women, and all the other strange creatures that her mother had described. "All right, I'll phone him and say he can make them a box. But I'll keep the key to it." Risa dropped a kiss on her forehead, and she carefully passed her hand over the notebook in Meggie's lap.
"Does anyone in the world bind books more beautifully than your father?" her fingers asked.
Meggie shook her head with a smile.
"No," she whispered. "No one in this world, or any other."
When Risa went downstairs again to help Darius and Eleanor with supper, Meggie stayed by the window to watch Eleanor's garden filling with shadows. When a squirrel scurried over the lawn, its bushy tail stretched out behind it, she was reminded of Dustfinger's tame marten, Gwyn.
How strange that she now understood the yearning she had so often seen on his master's scarred face.
Yes, Mo was probably right. She thought about Dustfinger's world too much, far too much. She had even read some of Reese's stories aloud a few times, although didn't she know how dangerous her voice could be when it spoke the words on the page? Hadn't she, to be perfectly honest, more honest than people usually are, hadn't she cherished a secret hope that the words would take her to that world?
What would Mo have done if he'd known about these experiments? Would he have buried the notebooks in the garden or thrown them into the lake, as he sometimes threatened to do with the stray cats that stole into his workshop?
Yes, I'll lock them away, thought Maggie, as the first stars appeared outside. As soon as Mo has made them a new box. The box with her favorite books in it was crammed full now. It was red, red as poppies. Mo had only recently repainted it. The box for the notebooks must be a different color. Perhaps green, like the wayless wood that Risa had described so often. Yes, green. And didn't the guards outside the Laughing Prince's castle wear green cloaks, too? A moth fluttered against the window, reminding Maggie of the blue-skinned fairies and the best of all the stories that Risa had told her about them. How they healed Dustfinger's face after Basta had slashed it, in gratitude to him for the many times he had freed their sisters from the wire cages where peddlers imprisoned them to sell them at market as good luck charms. And deep in the wayless wood he... No, that's enough. Maggie leaned her forehead against the cool pane.
Quite enough.
I'll take them all to Mo's workshop, she thought, at once. And when he's back, I'll ask him to buy me a new notebook for stories about this world of ours. She had already begun writing some, about Eleanor's garden and her library, about the castle down by the lake. Robbers had once lived there. Eleanor had told her about them in her own typical storytelling style, with so many grisly details that Darius, listening, forgot to go on sorting books, and his eyes widened in horror behind his thick glasses.
"Maggie! Supper time!"
Eleanor's call echoed right to the top of the stairs. She had a very powerful voice, louder than the Titanic's foghorn, Mo had always said. Maggie slipped off the windowsill.
"Coming,"
she called down the corridor. Then she went back into her room, took the notebooks off the shelf one by one until her arms could hardly hold the stack, and carried the precarious pile down the corridor and into the room that Mo used as an office. It had once been Maggie's bedroom. She'd slept there when she first came to Eleanor's house with Mo and Dustfinger, but all you could see from its window was the gravel forecourt, some spruce trees, a large chestnut, and Eleanor's gray station wagon, which stood out of doors in all weather because it was Eleanor's opinion that cars living in luxury in a garage rusted more quickly. But when they had decided to come and live there, Maggie had wanted a window with a view of the garden. So, Mo, surrounded by Eleanor's collection of old travel guides, did his paperwork in the room where Maggie had slept before she ever went to Capricorn's village, when she still had no mother and almost never quarreled with Mo.
"Maggie, where are you?"
Eleanor's voice sounded impatient. Her joints often ached these days, but she refused to go to the doctor.
"What's the point?"
was her only comment.
"They haven't invented a pill to cure old age, have they?"
"I'll be down in a minute,"
called Maggie, carefully lowering the notebooks onto Mo's desk. Two of them slipped off the pile and almost knocked over the vase of autumn flowers that her mother had put by the window. Maggie caught it just before the water spilled over Mo's invoices and receipts for gasoline. She was standing there with the vase still in her hand, her fingers sticky with drifting pollen, when she saw the figure between the trees where the path came up from the road. Her heart began to thud so hard that the vase almost slipped out of her fingers again.
"Well, that just went to prove it. Mo was right. Maggie, take your head out of those books, or soon you won't know the difference between reality and your own imagination." He told her that so often, and now it was happening. She'd been thinking about Dustfinger only a moment ago, hadn't she?
And now, she saw someone standing out there in the night. Just like the time, more than a year ago, when she'd seen Dustfinger waiting outside their house, motionless as the figure she saw there now.
Oh, Maggie! Oh, for heaven's sakes! How many more times do I have to call you?
Eleanor was wheezing from climbing all the stairs.
What are you doing standing there rooted to the spot? Didn't you say, oh, good heavens, who's that?
You can see him, too? Maggie was so relieved she could have hugged Eleanor.
Of course I can!
The figure moved. Barefoot, it ran over the pale gravel.
It's that boy!
Eleanor sounded incredulous.
The one who helped the matchstick eater steal the book from your father! But he's got nerve turning up here. Looks somewhat worse for wear. Think I'm going to let him in? Ha! I dare say the matchstick eater's out there, too!
Eleanor came close to the window, looking anxious, but Maggie was already out of the door. She ran downstairs, raced through the entrance hall. Her mother came along the corridor leading to the kitchen.
Risa!
Maggie called.
Farid's here! It's Farid!
Chapter 5. Farid. Risa took Farid into the kitchen and tended to his feet first. They looked terrible, cut and bleeding. While Risa cleaned them and put bandages over the cuts, Farid began telling his story. His tongue was heavy with weariness. Maggie did her best not to stare at him too often. He was still rather taller than she was, even though she'd grown a great deal since they last met, on the night when he'd gone off with Dustfinger. Dustfinger and the book. She hadn't forgotten his face, any more than she could forget the day when Mo first read him out of his own story in Tales from the Thousand and One Nights. She never met a boy with such beautiful eyes, almost like a girl's. They were as black as his hair, which was cut a little shorter than it had been in the old days and made him look more grown up. Farid. Maggie felt her tongue relishing his name and quickly turned her eyes away when he raised his head and looked at her. Eleanor stared at him all the time without any embarrassment and with as much hostility as she had shown in scrutinizing Dustfinger when he had sat at her kitchen table feeding his Martin bread and ham. She hadn't let Farid bring the Martin into the house with him.
And if he eats a single songbird in my garden, he'd better watch out,
she said as the Martin scurried away over the pale gravel. She had bolted the door after him, as if Gwyn could open locked doors as easily as his master. Farid played with the book of matches as he told his tale.
Look at that,
Eleanor whispered to Maggie,
just like the matchstick eater. Don't you think he looks a lot like him?
But Maggie did not reply. She didn't want to miss a word of the story Farid had to tell. She wanted to hear everything about Dustfinger's return, about the man with the hellhound who read aloud so well, about the snarling creature that could have been one of the big cats from the Wayless Wood, and about the words that Basta had shouted after Farid.
Oi! You can run, but I'll get you yet, do you hear? You, the fire-eater, Silvertongue and his hoity-toity daughter, and that old man who wrote those accursed words, I'll kill you all, one by one!
While Farid told his story, Risa's eyes kept straying to the grubby piece of paper he had put down on the kitchen table. She looked at it as if she were afraid of it, as if the words on that paper could draw her back again, back to the ink world. When Farid repeated the threat Basta had shouted, she put her arms around Maggie and held her close. But Darius, who'd been sitting next to Eleanor in silence all this time, buried his face in his hands. Farid didn't waste much time describing how he had gotten to Eleanor's house on his bare bloody feet. In answer to Maggie's questions, he just muttered something about getting a lift from a truck driver. He ended his account abruptly, as if he had suddenly run out of words. And when he fell silent, it was very quiet in the big kitchen. Farid had brought an invisible guest with him. Fear.
Put more coffee on, Darius,
said Eleanor as she looked gloomily at the table laid for supper. No one was taking any notice of it.
This could be iced tea. It's so cold.
Darius set to work at once,
busy and eager, like a bespectacled squirrel, while Eleanor gave Farida a glance as cold as if he were personally responsible for the bad news he had brought. Maggie still remembered just how alarming she had once found that look. The woman with the pebble eyes, she had secretly called Eleanor. Sometimes the name still fitted.
Yeah, what a terrific story,
exclaimed Eleanor as Risa went to give Darius a hand. Farid's news had obviously made him so nervous that he couldn't measure out the right amount of ground coffee. He had just begun counting the spoonfuls he was tipping into the filter for the third time when Risa gently took the measuring spoon from his hand.
So, Buster's back with a brand new knife and a mouthful of peppermint leaves, I suspect. Bloody hell!
Eleanor was apt to swear when she was anxious or annoyed.
As if it wasn't bad enough waking up every third night drenched in sweat because I've seen his foxy face in my dreams, not to mention his knife. But let's try to keep calm. Look at it like this. Buster knows where I live, but obviously it's Mo and Maggie he's after, not me. So this house ought really to be as safe as, well, safe as houses. For you. After all, he's not likely to know you've moved in here, is he?
She looked at Risa and Maggie triumphantly, as if this were a conclusive argument. But Maggie's response made Eleanor's face darken again at once. Farid knew, she pointed out.
So he did,
growled Eleanor, her glance turning to Farid again.
You knew, too. How?
Her voice was so sharp that Farid instinctively flinched.
An old woman told us, he said in a wavering voice. We went back to Capricorn's village after the fairies Dustfinger took with him turned to ashes. He wanted to see if the same thing had happened to the others. The whole village was deserted. Not a soul in sight. Not even a stray dog. Only ashes. Ashes everywhere. So we went to the next village and tried to find out just what had happened, and, well, that was when we heard how a fat woman had been there saying something about dead fairies. But at least, she said, luckily the human beings hadn't died on her too, and they were living with her now.
Eleanor lowered her gaze guiltily and collected a few crumbs from her plate with one finger.
Damn it,
she muttered.
Yes, perhaps I did say rather too much in that shop when I phoned you from there. I was in such a state after seeing the empty village. How could I guess those gossips would tell Dustfinger about me? Dustfinger, of all people, since when do old women talk to someone like him?
Or to someone like Basta,
thought Maggie. But Farid just shrugged his shoulders, rose to his feet, which are now covered with bandages, and began limping up and down Eleanor's kitchen.
Dustfinger thought you'd all be here in any case, he said. We even passed this way once because he wanted to see if she was all right. He jerked his head Reese's way.
Eleanor snorted scornfully.
Oh, did he indeed? How good of him!
She had never liked Dustfinger, and the fact that he had stolen the book from Mo before disappearing had done little to lessen her dislike. Risa, however, smiled at Farid's words, though she tried to hide her smile from Eleanor. Maggie still clearly remembered the morning when Darius had brought her mother the strange little bundle he'd found outside the front door. A candle, a few pencils, and a box of matches, all tied up with stems of blue speedwell. Maggie had known at once who the bundle came from, and so did Risa.
Well, said Eleanor, drumming on her plate with the handle of her knife, I'm delighted to hear that the matchstick eater's back where he belongs. The very idea of him slinking around my house by night. It's just a pity he didn't take Buster, too.
Buster? When Eleanor said his name, Risa suddenly rose from her chair, went out into the corridor, and came back with the telephone. She held it out to Maggie with a look of entreaty in her eyes and began gesticulating so excitedly with the other hand that even Maggie had difficulty in reading the signs she traced in the air, but finally she understood. Risa wanted her to call Mo. Of course. It seemed forever before he came to the phone. He'd probably been working. When Mo was away, he always worked late into the night so that he could get home sooner.
Maggie?
He sounded surprised. Perhaps he thought she was calling because of their quarrel. But who'd be interested in that stupid argument now? It was some time before he could make out anything of the words she was hastily stammering out.
Slowly, Maggie.
He kept saying, take it slowly.
But that was easier said than done when your heart was in your mouth and Boston might be waiting at Eleanor's gate this very minute. Maggie didn't even dare to think this idea through to its logical conclusion.
Mo, on the other hand, remained strangely calm, almost as if he had expected the past to catch up with them again. Stories never really end, Maggie, he had once told her. Even if the books like to pretend they do, stories always go on. They don't end on the last page any more than they begin on the first page. Has Eleanor switched on the burglar alarm? He asked now.
Yes.
Has she told the police?
No. She says they wouldn't believe her anyway.
Well, she ought to call them all the same and give them a description of Basta. You can describe him between you, right?
What a question. Maggie had tried to forget Basta's face, but it would live on in her memory for the rest of her life, as clear as a photograph.
Listen, Maggie, perhaps Mo wasn't quite as calm as he pretended. His voice didn't sound the same as usual. I'll drive back tonight. Tell Eleanor and your mother I'll be with you by tomorrow morning at the latest. Bolt everything and keep the windows closed. Understand? Maggie nodded, forgetting that Mo couldn't see her over the phone.
Maggie.
Yes, I understand.
She tried to sound calm and brave, even if she didn't feel that way. She was scared. Badly scared.
I'll see you tomorrow, Maggie.
She could tell from his voice that he was going to set out right away. And suddenly seeing the moonlit road in her mind's eye, the long road back, a new and terrible thought came into her mind.
What about you?
She exclaimed.
Mo, suppose Basta's lying in wait for you somewhere.
But her father had already hung up. Eleanor decided to put Farid where Dustfinger had once slept, in the attic room, where crates of books were stacked high around the narrow bedstead. Anyone who slept there would surely dream of being struck dead by printed paper. Maggie was told to show Farid the way, and when she wished him good night, he just nodded abstractedly. He looked very lost sitting on the narrow bed, almost as lost as on the day when Mo read him into Capricorn's church, a thin, nameless boy with a turban over his black hair. That night, before she went to sleep, Eleanor checked the burglar alarm several times to make sure it really was switched on. As for Darius, he went to find the shotgun that Eleanor sometimes fired into the air if she saw a cat prowling under one of the bird's nests in her garden. Wearing the orange bathrobe that Eleanor had given him last Christmas, it was much too big for him. He settled down in the armchair in the entrance hall, the gun on his lap, staring at the front door with a determined expression. When Eleanor came to check the alarm for the second time, he was already fast asleep. It was a long time before Maggie could sleep. She looked at the shelves where her notebooks used to stand, stroked the empty wood, and finally kneeled down by the red-painted box that Mo had made long ago for her favorite books. She hadn't opened it for months. There wasn't room in it for a single extra book. And by now, it was too heavy for her to take it when she went away. So Eleanor had given her the bookcase to hold more of the books she loved. It stood beside Maggie's bed, and it had glass doors and carvings that twined over the dark wood, making it look as if it hadn't forgotten that it was once alive. And the shelves behind the glass doors were well filled, for by now Risa and Eleanor, as well as Mo, gave Maggie books. And even Darius brought her a new one now and then. But her old friends, the books Maggie had already owned before they moved in with Eleanor, still lived in the box. And when she opened the heavy lid, it was almost as if half-forgotten voices met her ears and familiar faces were looking at her. How well-worn they all were. Isn't it odd how much fatter a book gets when you've read it several times? Mo had said when on Maggie's last birthday they were looking at all her dear old books again. As if something were left between the pages every time you read it. Feelings, thoughts, sounds, smells. And then, when you look at the book again many years later, You find yourself there, too. A slightly younger self. Slightly different. As if the book had preserved you like a pressed flower. Both strange and familiar. Slightly younger. Yes. Maggie picked up one of the books lying on top and leafed through it. She had read it at least a dozen times. Ah, here was the scene she had liked best when she was 8. And there was the one she'd marked with a red pencil when she was 10 because she thought it was so beautiful. She ran her finger down the wobbly line. There'd been no Risa in her life then. No Eleanor. No Darius. Only Mo. No longing to see blue fairies. No memories of a scarred face. A marten with little horns. And a boy who always went barefoot. No memory of Basta and his knife. A different Maggie had read that book, very different. And there she would stay between its pages, preserved as a memento. With a sigh, Maggie closed the book again and put it back with the others. She could hear her mother pacing up and down next door. Did she, like Maggie, keep thinking of the threat that Basta had shouted after Farid?
I have to go to her, thought Maggie. Perhaps our fear won't be so bad if we're together.
But just as she was getting up, Reese's footsteps died away, and it was quiet in the room next door. Quiet as sleep. Maybe sleep wasn't a bad idea. Most certainly wouldn't arrive any sooner just because she was awake and waiting for him. Oh, if only she could at least have called him. But he was always forgetting to switch his cell phone on. Maggie closed the lid of her book box softly, as if the sound might wake Risa again, and blew out the candles that she lit every evening, although Eleanor was always telling her not to. As she was taking her T-shirt off over her head, she heard a knock at her door, a very quiet knock. She opened the door, expecting to see her mother outside because she couldn't sleep after all. But it was Farid. He went scarlet in the face when he saw that she was wearing only her underclothes. He stammered an apology, and before Maggie could say anything, limped away again on his lavishly bandaged feet. She almost forgot to pull the T-shirt back on before going after him.
"What's the matter?"
she whispered anxiously as she beckoned him back into her room.
"Did you hear anything downstairs?"
But Farid shook his head. He was holding the piece of paper in his hand. Dust fingers return ticket, as Eleanor had tartly described it. Hesitantly, he followed Maggie into her room and looked around it like someone who doesn't feel comfortable in enclosed spaces. Ever since he disappeared with Dust Finger, leaving no trace behind, he had probably spent most of his days and nights in the open air.
I'm sorry, Farid stammered, staring at his toes. Two of Reese's bandages were already peeling off. I know it's late, but...
And for the first time, he looked Maggie in the eye, turning red again as he did so.
But Orpheus says he didn't read it all, he went on, his voice hesitating. He just left out the words that would have taken me into the book, too. He did it on purpose. But I have to warn Dustfinger. So what?
Maggie pushed the chair from the desk over to him and sat down on the windowsill herself. Farid sat down as hesitantly as he had entered the room.
You must get me there, too. Please.
He held the dirty piece of paper out to her again, with such a pleading expression in his black eyes that Maggie didn't know where to look.
How long and thick his eyelashes were. Hers were nowhere near as beautiful.
Please, I know you can do it, he stammered. I remember that night in Capricorn's village. I remember all about it, and you had only a single sheet of paper then.
That night in Capricorn's village, Maggie's heart always began to thud when she thought of it. The night when she had read the shadow into appearing, and then hadn't been able to make him kill Capricorn, until Mo did it for her.
Orpheus wrote the words, he said so himself, he just didn't read them aloud, but they're here, on this paper. Of course my actual name isn't there, or it wouldn't work.
Farid was speaking faster and faster.
Orpheus says that's the secret of it. If you want to change the story, you must only use words that are already in the book, if possible.
He said that? Maggie's heart missed a beat. As if it had stumbled over Farid's information.
You must only use words that are already in the book, if possible.
Was that why she'd never been able to read anything out of Risa's stories, because she'd used words that weren't in Inkheart? Or was it because she didn't know enough about writing?
Yes, Orpheus thinks he's so clever because of the way he can read aloud.
Farid spat out the man's name like a plum pit. But if you ask me, he's not half as good at it as you or your father.
Maybe not, thought Maggie.
But he read Dustfinger back, and he wrote the words for it himself. Neither Mo nor I could have done that. She took from Farid the piece of paper with the passage that Orpheus had written. The handwriting was difficult to decipher, but it was beautiful. Very individual and curiously ornate.
When exactly did Dustfinger disappear?
Farid shrugged. I don't know, he muttered, abashed. Of course, she'd forgotten that he couldn't read.
Maggie traced the first sentence with her finger. Dustfinger returned on a day fragrant with the scent of berries and mushrooms. Thoughtfully, she lowered the piece of paper. It's no good, she said. We don't even have the book. How can it work without the book?
But Orpheus didn't use the book either. Dustfinger took it away from him before he read the words on that paper.
Farid pushed his chair back and came to stand beside her. Feeling him so close made Maggie uneasy. She didn't try to figure out why. But that can't be so, she murmured. Dustfinger had gone, though. A few handwritten sentences had opened the door between the words on the page for him. The door that Mo had tried to batter down so unsuccessfully. And it was not Finolio, the author of the book, who had written those sentences, but a stranger. A stranger with the curious name. Orpheus. Maggie knew more than most people about what waited beyond the words. She herself had already opened doors and lured living, breathing creatures out of faded, yellowing pages. And she had been there when her father had read this boy out of an Arabian fairy tale. The boy of flesh and blood now standing beside her. However, this Orpheus seemed to know far, far more than she did, even more than Mo. Farid still called him Silvertongue, and suddenly, Maggie was afraid of the words on the grubby piece of paper. She put it down on her desk as if it had burned her fingers. Please, do please, at least, try. Farid's voice sounded almost pleading. Suppose Orpheus has already read Basta back after all. Dustfinger has to learn that they're in league with each other. He thinks he's safe from Basta in his own world.
Maggie was still staring at the words written by Orpheus. They sounded beautiful, enchantingly beautiful. Maggie felt her tongue longing to taste them. She very nearly began reading them aloud. Horrified, she clapped her hand to her mouth. Orpheus. Of course she knew the name, and the story that surrounded it like a tangle of flowers and thorns. Eleanor had given her a book with a beautiful poem about him in it. Orpheus with his lute-made trees, and the mountaintops that freeze, bow themselves when he did sing, to his music plants and flowers, ever sprung, as sun and showers, there had made a lasting spring. Everything that heard him play, even the billows of the sea, hung their heads, and then lay by. In sweet music is such art, killing care. And grief of heart. Fall asleep, or hearing die. She looked at Farid with a question in her eyes.
How old is he?
Orpheus, Farid shrugged.
20, 25, how should I know? Difficult to say. His face is like a child's.
So young. But the words in the paper didn't sound like a young man's words. They sounded as if they knew a great many things.
Please. Farid was still looking at her. You will try, won't you?
Maggie looked out the window. She couldn't help thinking of the empty fairy's nests, the glass men who had vanished, and something Dustfinger had said to her long ago.
Sometimes, when you went to the well to wash early in the morning, those tiny fairies would be whirring above the water, hardly bigger than the dragonflies you have here, and blue as violets. They weren't very friendly, but by night, they shone like glowworms.
All right, she said, and it was almost as if someone else were answering Farid. All right, I'll try. But your feet must be better first,
The world my mother talks about isn't a place where you want to be lame.
Nonsense, my feet are fine.
Fareed walked up and down on the soft carpet as if to prove it.
You can try right away as far as I'm concerned.
But Maggie shook her head. No, she said firmly. I must learn to read it fluently first. That's not going to be easy given his handwriting. And it's smeared in several places, so I'll probably copy it out. This man Orpheus wasn't lying. He did write something about you, but I'm not quite sure that it will do. And if I try it, she went on, trying to sound very casual.
If I try it, then I want to come with you.
What?
Yes, why not?
Maggie couldn't keep her voice from showing how hurt she felt by his horrified look. Fareed did not reply.
Didn't he understand that she wanted to see it for herself? She wanted to see everything that Dustfinger and her mother had told her about. Dustfinger, in a voice soft with longing, the fairies swarming above the grass, trees so high that you thought they would catch the clouds in their branches, the wayless wood, the strolling players, the laughing prince's castle, the silver towers of the castle of night, the Umbra market, the fire that danced for him, the whispering pool where the water nymph's faces looked up at you?
No, Fareed didn't understand. He had probably never felt that yearning for a completely different world, any more than he felt the homesickness that had broken Dustfinger's heart. Fareed wanted just one thing. He wanted to find Dustfinger, warn him of Basta's knife, and be back with him again. He was Dustfinger's shadow. That was the part he wanted to play, never mind what story they were in.
Forget it, you can't come too.
Without looking at Maggie, he limped back to the chair she had given him, sat down, and pulled off the bandages that Risa had so carefully put on his toes.
People can't read themselves into a book. Even Orpheus can't. He told Dustfinger so himself. He's tried it several times, he said, and it just won't work.
Oh, no?
Maggie tried to sound more sure of herself than she felt.
You said yourself that I read better than he does, so perhaps I can make it work. Even if I can't write as well as he does, she added to herself.
Fareed cast her an uneasy glance as he put the bandages in his trouser pocket.
But it's dangerous there, he said, particularly for a girl.
He didn't finish the word. Instead, he began inspecting his blood-stained toes, intently. Idiot! Maggie's anger tasted bitter on her tongue. Who did he think she was? She probably knew more about the world she'd been reading him into than he did.
I know it's dangerous, she said, piqued. Either I go with you, or I don't read aloud from this sheet of paper. You must make up your mind, and now you'd better leave me alone. I have to think.
Fareed cast a final glance at the piece of paper with Orpheus's words on it before he went to the door.
When will you try? He asked before he went back out into the corridor. Tomorrow?
Perhaps, was all Maggie would say. Then she closed the door behind him and was alone with the words that Orpheus had written. Chapter 6 The Inn of the Strolling Players. It took Dustfinger 2 whole days to get through the wayless wood. He met very few people on the way, a few charcoal burners blackened with soot, a ragged poacher with 2 rabbits slung over his shoulder and hunger written large on his face, and a group of the prince's game wardens, armed to the teeth, probably on the trail of some poor devil who had shot a deer to feed his children. None of them saw Dustfinger. He knew how to pass unseen, and only on the second night, when he heard a pack of wolves howling in the nearby hills, did he dare to summon fire. Fire. So different in this world than in the other one. How good it would be to hear its crackling voice again at last, and to be able to answer. Dustfinger collected some of the dry wood lying around among the trees, with wax flowers and thyme rambling over it. He carefully unwrapped the fire elf's stolen honey from the leaves that kept it moist and supple and put a tiny morsel in his mouth. How scared he had been the first time he tasted the honey. Scared that his precious booty would burn his tongue forever and he would lose his voice. But that fear had proved groundless. The honey did burn your mouth like red-hot coals, but the pain passed away, and if you bore it long enough, then afterward, you could speak to fire.
even with a mere human tongue. The effect of a tiny piece lasted for 5 or 6 months, sometimes almost a year. Just a soft whisper in the language of the flames, the snap of your fingers, and sparks would leap crackling from dry wood, damp wood, even stone. At first the fire licked up from the twigs more reluctantly than it had in the old days, as if it couldn't really believe he was back. But then it began to whisper and welcome him more and more exuberantly until he had to rein in those wildly leaping flames, imitating the sound of their crackling until the fire sank lower, like a wildcat that will crouch down and purr if you stroke its fur carefully enough. While the fire devoured the wood and its light kept the wolves away, Dustfinger found himself thinking of the boy again. He couldn't count the many nights when he'd had to tell Farid how fire spoke. For the boy knew only mute and sullen flames.
"Heavens above," he muttered to himself as he warmed his fingers over the glowing embers. "You're still missing him."
He was glad that the marten at least was still with the boy, to keep him company as he faced the ghosts he saw everywhere. Yes, Dustfinger did miss Farid. But there were others whom he had been missing for 10 long years, missing them so much that his heart was still sore with longing. It was with those people crowding his mind that he strode out, more impatiently with every passing hour, as he approached the outskirts of the forest and what lay beyond it, the world of the humans. It was not just his longing for fairies, little glass men, and water nymphs that had tormented him in the other world, nor his desire to be back in the silence under the trees. There weren't many human beings he had missed, but he had missed those few all the more fiercely. He tried so hard to forget them since the day he came, half-starved, to Silvertongue's door, and Silvertongue had explained that there could be no way back for him. It was then he had realized that he must choose. "Forget them, Dustfinger." How often he'd told himself that. "Forget them, or the loss of them and all will drive you mad." But his heart simply did not obey. Memories. So sweet. And so bitter. They had both nourished and devoured him for so many years, until a time came when they began to fade, turning faint and blurred, only an ache to be quickly pushed away because it went to your heart. For what was the use of remembering all you had lost?
"Better not remember them now either," Dustfinger told himself as the trees around him became younger and the canopy of leaves above grew lighter. 10 years. It's a long time. And many may be lost and gone by now.
Charcoal burners' huts appeared among the trees more and more often now, but Dustfinger did not let the soot-blackened men see him. Outside the forest, people spoke of them slightingly, for the charcoal burners lived deeper in the forest than most dared to go. Craftsmen, peasants, traders, princes, they all needed charcoal, but they didn't like to see the men who burned it for them in their towns and villages. Dustfinger liked the charcoal burners, who knew almost as much about the forest as he did, although they made enemies of the trees daily. He had sat by their fires often enough, listening to their stories. But after all these years, there were other stories he wanted to hear, tales of what had been going on outside the forest. And there was only one place to hear those, in one of the inns that stood along the road. Dustfinger had one particular inn in mind. It lay on the northern outskirts of the forest, where the road appeared among the trees and began to wind uphill, past a few isolated farms, until it reached the city gate of Ombra, the capital city of Lombrica, the Laughing Prince's realm. The inns on the road outside Ombra had always been places where the strolling players called the motley folk met. They offered their skills to rich merchants, tradesmen, and craftsmen, for weddings and funerals, for festivities to celebrate a traveler's safe return, or the birth of a child. They would provide music, earthy jokes, and conjuring tricks just for a few coins, taking the audience's minds off their troubles, large and small. And if Dustfinger wanted to find out what had been happening in all the years he was away, then the motley folk were the people to ask. The players were the newspapers of this world. No one knew what went on in it better than these travelers who were never at home anywhere.
"Well, who knows?"
thought Dustfinger as he walked down the road with the autumn sun, by now low in the sky, on his face. "If I'm lucky, I may even meet old acquaintances."
The road was muddy and full of puddles. Cartwheels had made deep ruts in it, and the hoofprints left by oxen and horses were full of rainwater. At this time of year, it sometimes rained for days on end, as it had yesterday, when he had been glad to be under the trees where the leaves caught the rain before it drenched into the skin. The night had been cold, all the same, and his clothes were clammy even though he had slept beside his fire.
He was glad that the sky was clear today, apart from a few shreds of cloud drifting over the hills.
Luckily, he had found a few coins in his old clothes. He hoped it'd be enough for a bowl of soup. Dustfinger had brought nothing with him from the other world. What would he do here with the printed paper they used for money in that world? Only gold, silver, and ringing copper counted in this one, with the local prince's head on the coins if possible. As soon as his money was gone, he'd have to look for a marketplace where he could perform, in Ombra or elsewhere. The inn that was his destination hadn't changed much in the last few years, either for better or for worse. It was as shabby as ever, with a few windows that were hardly more than holes in the gray stone walls. In the world where he had been living until 3 days ago, it was unlikely that any guests at all would have crossed such a grubby threshold. But here, the inn was the last shelter available before you entered the forest, the last chance of a hot meal and a place to sleep that wasn't damp with dew or rain, and you got a few lice and bugs thrown in for free, thought Dustfinger as he pushed open the door. It was so dark in the room inside that his eyes took a little while to adjust to the dim light. The other world had spoiled him with all its lights, with the brightness that made even night into day there. It had accustomed him to seeing everything clearly, to thinking of light as something you could switch on and off, available whenever you wanted. But now his eyes must cope again with a world of twilight and shadows, of long nights as black as charred wood, and houses from which the sunlight was often shut out because its heat was unwelcome. All the light inside the inn came from the few sunbeams falling through the holes that were the windows. Dust motes danced in them like a swarm of tiny fairies. A fire was burning in the hearth under a battered black cauldron. The smell rising from it was not particularly appetizing, even to Dustfinger's empty stomach, but that didn't surprise him. This inn had never had a landlord and knew the first thing about cooking. A little girl hardly more than 10 years old was standing beside the cauldron, stirring whatever it was simmering in it with a stick. Some 30 guests were sitting on rough-hewn benches in the dark, smoking, talking quietly, and drinking. Dustfinger strolled over to an empty place and sat down. He surreptitiously looked around for a face that might seem familiar, for a pair of the motley trousers that only the players wore. He immediately saw a lute player by the window, negotiating with a much better-dressed man than the musician himself, probably a rich merchant. No poor peasant could afford to hire an entertainer, of course. If a farmer wanted music at his wedding, he must play the fiddle himself. He couldn't have afforded even 2 pipers who were also sitting by the window. At the table next to them, a group of actors were arguing in loud voices, probably about who got the best part in the new play. One still wore the mask behind which he hid when they acted in the town's marketplaces. He looked strange sitting there among the others. But then, all the motley folk were strange, with or without masks. Whether they sang or danced, performed broad farces on a wooden stage, or breathed fire. The same was true of their companions, traveling physicians, bone-setters, stone-cutters, miracle healers. The players brought them customers. Old faces, young faces, happy and unhappy faces. There were all of those in the smoke-filled room, but none of them seemed familiar to Dustfinger. He, too, sensed he was being scrutinized, but he was used to it. His scarred face attracted glances everywhere, and the clothes he wore did the rest. A fire-eater's costume, black as soot, red as the flames that he played with, but which others feared. For a moment, he felt curiously strange amid all this once familiar activity, as if the other world still clung to him and could be clearly seen. All the years, the endless years since Silvertongue plucked him out of his own story and stole his life without intending to, as you might crush a snail shell in passing.
"Hey, who have we here?"
A hand fell heavily on his shoulder, and a man leaned over him and stared at his face. His hair was gray, his face round and beardless, and he was so unsteady on his feet that for a moment Dustfinger thought he was drunk.
Well, I don't know that face,
cried the man incredulously, grasping Dustfinger's shoulder hard as if to make sure it was really flesh and blood.
So, where have you sprung from, oh fire-eating friend? Straight from the realm of the dead? What happened? Did the fairies bring you back to life? They always were besotted with you, those little blue imps.
A few men turned to look at them, but there was so much noise in the dark, stuffy room that not many people noticed what was going on.
Cloud Dancer!
Dustfinger straightened up and embraced the other man. How are you?
And there I was thinking you forgot me.
Cloud Dancer gave a broad grin bearing large yellow teeth. Oh, no. Dustfinger had not forgotten him, although he had tried to, as he had tried to forget the others he had missed. Cloud Dancer, the best tightrope walker who ever strolled around the rooftops. Dustfinger had recognized him at once, in spite of his now gray hair and the left leg that was skewed at such a curiously stiff angle.
Ah, come along. We must drink to this. You don't meet your dead friend again every day.
He impatiently drew Dustfinger over to a bench under one of the windows. A little sunlight fell through it from outside. Then he signaled to the girl who was still stirring the cauldron and ordered two goblets of wine. The little creature stared at Dustfinger's scars for a moment, fascinated, and then scurried over to the counter. A fat man stood behind it, watching his guests with dull eyes.
Oh, you looking good,
remarked Cloud Dancer.
Well fed? Not a gray hair on your head. Hardly a hole in your clothes.
Yeah, you still have all your teeth by the look of it.
Where have you been? Maybe I should set out for the same place myself. Seems like a man can live pretty well there.
Forget it. It's better here. Dustfinger pushed back the hair from his forehead and looked around. That's enough about me. How have you been yourself? You can afford wine, but your hair is grey. And your left leg.
My leg.
The girl brought their wine. As Cloud Dancer searched his purse for the right money, she stared at Dustfinger again with such curiosity that he rubbed his fingertips together and whispered a few fire words. Reaching out his forefinger, he smiled at her and blew gently on the fingertip. A tiny flame, too weak to light a fire, but just bright enough to be reflected in the little girl's eyes, flickered on his nail and spat out sparks of gold on the dirty table. The child stood there enchanted until Dustfinger blew out the flame and dipped his finger in the goblet of wine that Cloud Dancer pushed over to him.
So you still like playing with fire?
Said Cloud Dancer, as the girl cast an anxious glance at the fat landlord and hurried back to the cauldron.
My own games are over now, sad to say.
What happened?
I fell off the rope. Don't dance in the clouds anymore. A market trader threw a cabbage at me. I expect I was distracting his customers' attention.
At least I was lucky enough to land on a cloth merchant's stall. That way I broke my leg and a couple of ribs, but not my neck.
Dustfinger looked at him thoughtfully.
Then how do you make a living now that you can't walk the tightrope?
Cloud Dancer shrugged.
Believe it or not, I can still go about on foot. I can even ride with this leg of mine, if there's a horse available. I earn my living as a messenger, although I still like being with the strolling players, listening to their stories and sitting by the fire with them. But it's words that nourish me now, even though I can't read. Threatening letters, begging letters, love letters, sales contracts, wills. I deliver anything that can be written on a piece of parchment or paper, and I can be relied upon to carry a spoken message, too, when it's been whispered into my ear in confidence. I make quite a good living, although I'm not the fastest messenger money can hire. But everyone who gives me a letter to deliver knows that it really will reach the person it's meant for, and a guarantee of that is hard to find.
Dustfinger believed him. For a few gold pieces, you can even read the prince's own letters.
That was what they used to say even in his own time. You just had to know someone who was good at forging broken seals.
How about our other friends?
Dustfinger looked at the pipers by the window.
What are they doing?
Cloud Dancer took a sip of wine and made a face.
Whew, I should have asked for any in this. The others, well,
he rubbed his stiff leg. Well,
some are dead. Some have just disappeared like you.
Look over there. Bland Farmer staring so gloomily into his tankard, he said, jerking his head at the counter.
There's our old friend Sudbird. With a laugh fixed on his face like a tattoo. The worst fire eater for miles around, although he still tries to copy you and wonders what fire would rather dance for you than him.
He'll never find out.
Dustfinger glanced surreptitiously at the other fire eater. As far as he remembered, Sootbird could juggle burning torches well enough, but fire didn't dance for him. He was like a hopeless lover rejected again and again by the girl of his choice. Long ago, feeling sorry for the man's futile efforts, Dustfinger had given him some fire elves' honey, but even with its aid, Sootbird hadn't understood what the flames were telling him.
I've heard that he works with powders bought from the alchemists now,
Cloud Dancer whispered across the table.
That's an expensive pastime, if you ask me. The fire bites him so often that his hands and arms are quite red from it. But he doesn't let it get at his face. Before he performs, he smears it with grease until it shines like bacon fat.
Does he still drink after every show?
After the show, before the show, but he's still a good-looking fellow, don't you think?
Yes, so he was, with his friendly, ever-smiling face. Sootbird was one of those entertainers who lived on the glances of others, on laughter and applause, on knowing that people will stop to look at them. Even now he was entertaining the others who were leaning against the counter with him. Dustfinger turned his back. He didn't want to see the old mixture of admiration and envy in the other man's eyes. Sootbird was not one of those he had missed.
You mustn't think that times are any easier now for the motley folk, said Cloud Dancer across the table, low-voiced. Since Cosimo's death, the Laughing Prince doesn't let the likes of us into the markets except on feast days. And as for going up to the castle itself, that's only when his grandson demands entertainers loudly enough. He's not a very nice little boy. He's already ordering his servants around and threatening them with whipping and the pillory. Still, he loves the motley folk.
Cosimo the Fair is dead?
Dustfinger nearly choked on the sour wine.
Yes, Cloud Dancer leaned over the table, as if it wasn't right to speak of death and misfortune in too loud a voice. He rode away scarcely a year ago, beautiful as an angel, to prove his princely courage and finish off the fire raisers who were haunting the forest then. You may remember their leader, Capricorn.
Dustfinger had to smile.
Yes. I remember him, he said quietly. He disappeared about the same time you did, but his gang carried on the same as ever. Firefox became their new leader. There wasn't a village nor a farm this side of the forest that was safe from them. So, Cosimo rode away to put an end to their evil deeds. He smoked out the whole band. But he didn't come home himself. Since then, his father, who used to like eating so much that his breakfast alone could have fed three whole villages, has become known as the Prince of Sighs, too. For the Laughing Prince does nothing but sigh these days.
Dustfinger held his fingers in the dust motes dancing above him in the sun.
The Prince of Sighs, he murmured. Well, well. And what about his noble highness on the other side of the forest?
The Anaid.
Cloud Dancer looked around uneasily.
Well, I'm afraid he's not dead yet. Still thinks himself lord of the whole world. When his game wardens find a peasant in the forest with a rabbit, he has the man blinded. He enslaves folk who won't pay their taxes and makes them dig the ground for silver until they're coughing up blood. The gallows outside his castle are always in use, and he likes to see a pair of motley trousers dangling there best of all. Still,
Few speak ill of him, because he has more spies than this inn has bedbugs, and he pays them well. But you can't bribe